I'm Jordanian. I'm 33. I'm a husband and a father. I'm a friend and an artist. I am not a terrorist. I live in London with my wife and daughter. She's 2. I can never forget the day I was arrested. They took me to Longlaughton Prison. The other men told me I was there because the Home Office believe I am a threat to national security. I left Jordan because of the torture. It was just too much to keep bearing. I still have the broken bones in my hand. When I got here, I applied for asylum. I thought I could start to live without fear and pain. My ambition was to study. I wanted to be a doctor. But that's all gone now. Can you imagine for just a second how it feels to be taken, to be labeled, to feel so useless in front of your family, to have a whole government of a country turn against you, and you don't know why? They say they have something secret on you. They won't tell you what. You have no real way of challenging it, and you have to live like this. I am here today because of something secret.
Did you know that in this country you could be detained and placed under virtual house arrest indefinitely, with no reasons given and without you or your lawyer ever seeing the evidence being used against you? That's what happened to Hussein Al-Samamara, the Jordanian recently imprisoned on the basis of secret evidence and told he posed a threat to national security. His story is just one of a number of films as part of our Slow Torture series, which launches this week. I'm Afua Hirsch, and this is Closed Court, a Guardian podcast examining the regime of secrecy in Britain's justice system. In this programme, we'll be looking at so-called secret evidence. What is it? How is it being used? And is it justified? To discuss these issues, I have a panel who have been deeply involved in this area in a number of different ways. We have Gareth Pearce, the solicitor who famously defended the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, and who has represented a number of men subject to control orders. Clive Stafford Smith is a human rights lawyer, the founder of Reprieve, and has spent 25 years working on behalf of defendants facing the death penalty in the USA. He has recently been volunteering his services to security detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and has also been at the forefront of challenging control orders. Ian MacDonald QC is a human rights barrister and has first-hand experience working as a special advocate before stepping down in 2004 because of the, quote, odious nature of emergency anti-terror laws rushed through Parliament after September the 11th. We also have our senior reporter Ian Cobain here, who has led a series for The Guardian on torture and measures used against terrorist suspects. Let's start by looking at exactly what secret evidence is. Clive Stafford Smith?
Well, I can't tell you. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? With the United States, which is where I get most of my experience, you know, we go to Guantanamo, for example, and every word that my clients tell me is classified secret unless the Americans want to let you unclassify it. And then in terms of the allegations against them, most of that is secret as well. And you have this bizarre situation where I'm allowed to see it. I couldn't tell you it, but I also can't tell my clients what that information is. And so you have to go and have a conversation with them, which you know these guys are listening into the whole time. And you have to be incredibly careful not to repeat any of these materials to the client. And the poor client's sitting there saying, what am I charged with? And you say, well, I know, but I can't tell you. It's absolutely bizarre. We get tired of using Orwellian and Kafkaesque and all those words, but I'm afraid that's what applies.
Gareth, how would you describe working with secret evidence?
Like the other lawyers here today, I used to be a defence lawyer. That was hard enough. Battling the power of the state on evidence that was made known to you. But since 9/11, our job has become completely different, which is be ineffectively there as so-called lawyers, but the court considering what the allegation is somewhere else entirely without telling the individual concerned. And it is virtually impossible to describe the effect on a person who is suddenly locked up or taken away from his family, but will never know the reason. And it perpetuates itself. It isn't that it came to an end. It's a story that we can now talk about in the past. It is, in fact, growing and being used more and more and more.
Ian MacDonald, can I ask you, does it feel that using secret evidence goes fundamentally against your role as an advocate?
Well, yes. I mean, I've been on both sides of the fence because I've been a special advocate and seen all the secret evidence that's going to be used. And only the secret evidence is going to be used. There's an awful lot of other stuff that we don't even see as special advocates. And I've been on the other side where you're totally guessing what on earth your client's supposed to have done, or if there's a particular issue, how that's going to be treated in secret. And it's a ridiculous situation because our experience here as being special advocates, the moment you see that secret evidence, you're not allowed to talk to Gareth or any of the other solicitors. And it's a totally ridiculous and bizarre and odious system, which is why I got out of it.
How are other advocates who are still operating in the system, how are they managing?
Well, I don't know how they're managing, because obviously when you're in there, I suppose people stay in there because they hope that they can make a difference. But you have to balance the difference that you might make, which I think is pretty minimal, against the fact that you're legitimising something that I regard as fundamentally wrong. And of course, one of the things that I think is that an awful lot of stuff is kept secret, which on one view would be kept secret simply because it's embarrassing to the government.
Ian Cobain, you've worked as a reporter on where some of this secret evidence comes from and what it's actually about. Can you tell us about that?
Well, like your other guests, in theory, I can't. But what I will say, yes, I will. What I will say is that I believe that courts have been persuaded to hear evidence in camera which shows serious criminal wrongdoing on the part of British government officials and on the part of British government ministers. And if I was to report on what I know has been heard in camera, in secret, in British courts, I'd be the one who'd face prosecution under the Contempt of Court Act, whereas the officials whose serious criminal wrongdoing is being concealed would probably not be facing prosecution.
Do you think that the difficulty in reporting these issues has meant that people aren't fully aware of what these issues actually are?
So far, they're not fully aware, no. If my own responsibility was to report on the proceedings, then secrecy in court wouldn't be a problem. If you view my job as being to try and give people an idea of what's going on around them, then secret court sessions make that really very difficult indeed. I think people are starting to understand what it may be that is being concealed from them. But the details of it, for example, details showing the way in which British government officials have arranged for British citizens and others to be tortured overseas, that sort of thing is still being successfully concealed from the public.
Gareth, you mentioned the impact that some of these proceedings have had on the lives of your clients. Can you give us any more insight into how it would affect somebody to become part of a case based on secret evidence?
A man last month who had grown up all his life in East London, a British man, a British wife, and 2.5 British children, 2 under 3, and his wife pregnant. He was suddenly taken from his house and put into the middle of a county in the middle of London, just taken from his house, and was said, "You're now under a control order, and it's an obligation under that control order that you no longer live in London, and you live in this arbitrary place, a small town with not a Muslim in sight, let alone a man with a beard, and this is where you will live. Why? We're not going to tell you." And that is it. That is all the evidence that man had. And not just him, another man too. And a third man, all from the same area, told, "We're going to do exactly the same to you." Now, any parent would know what effect that would have on the children, just for starters, if the father suddenly disappeared. What happens to children? They don't understand. They get in detention at school. They start wetting their beds. The the consequences for a whole family unit are unspeakable.
I mean, it's very important too, I think, that we get into the issue of who the people are who are subjected to these issues. I mean, of course, we can't talk about what the classified evidence is against them, but I can give you a good sense of it with our experience in America, where we've had to hold all of these hearings in secret. The clients, the prisoners are not allowed to be there. I'm there, the prosecutor's there, the judge is there, but the prisoner doesn't get to know what's going on. But of the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, for example, lest we trust the government to get it all right, this is after 7 years of interrogating people. They've whittled 779 prisoners down to 219. Supposedly, these are the worst of the worst of the worst people. And we're dealing with classified evidence where we can't talk to the clients. Judges so far have acquitted 84% of the prisoners that we've actually got in front of a court. So the government's got it wrong in the overwhelming majority of cases, but they won't tell the prisoner what it's all about.
Ian MacDonald, if I could just come back to you. The House of Lords recently ruled that the control order special advocates regime violates the right to a fair trial. What is your view on the current state of the law?
Well, I don't think they quite said it violates the right to a fair trial. They said that if there isn't enough information that goes to the core of the case being given, then the court can decide that there isn't a fair trial, and that's it.
How much evidence does there have to be for it to meet that standard?
Well, that's the problem, because they didn't say exactly what it is. They said that's a matter for the discretion of the court of first instance that's dealing with the case. Although it's, you know, giving a little bit more than there has been in the past, I don't think it overcomes the fundamental problem that an awful lot of stuff is, in fact, still kept behind closed doors. And there's no real way of challenging it. I mean, being given the gist of what is against you, if that makes a fair trial, it's a little bit like being told what's in the indictment. Now, one of the great problems that we fought a civil war on in this country was that people should be given information about what they were charged with and have an opportunity of answering it. Now, that seems to be disappearing in this particular kind of situation. And the question you have to ask, which is, do all these control orders and indefinite detentions and so forth actually protect us? And it seems to me that, in a way, all of these things are window dressing, because you can have any amount of control orders. You could have everyone who's in your sights under some kind of indefinite detention. But if you haven't got the intelligence to know who's about to do something, you're still going to have these explosions and incidents happening.
But in a way, and don't you think it's far worse than that? I mean, the issue is not just what the control orders do in terms of supposedly protecting society from those particular individuals. It's also how much this whole system angers people around the world. And I can't put it any better than the CIA agent did when he said that for every person we banged up in Guantanamo, for example, we have inspired 10 people to hate us so much that they want to blow us up. And if the government's job ultimately is to make us as a society safer, what they're achieving here is making us all in much, much greater jeopardy. I don't think anyone could possibly argue with that.
No, I totally agree with that.
Is this something that's happened in all European or Western countries that are claiming to be responding to the threat of terror with these laws? Or is the UK in a unique position?
We're leading the way. We're trying to persuade others to follow our example. We've always led the way, in fact, in miscarriages of justice and injustice. And we cloak it in our special British way with a panoply of psychodrama and courts and all of that, but it disguises the fact this is an absolute unscrupulous exercise of power, and it's intended to be, and we are trying to export it. However, most European countries haven't even gone near what we're doing here, but we're developing it. We're using it to freeze people's assets, to deport people to countries that will torture them. On what basis? An assurance. What's the assurance about? It's in secret.
Ian, you've done investigative work on this internationally. What's your view on how secret evidence and intelligence in this country is fitting in this global picture?
In the context of prosecutions and secret hearings in British criminal courts, what the courts are allowing themselves to be persuaded is that all evidence relating to British intelligence agencies' relationships with overseas intelligence agencies should be concealed from the public in order to protect and preserve those relationships. But if you have a situation in which British intelligence agencies are outsourcing the torture of British citizens and others to overseas intelligence agencies, and there's evidence that that is what's going on, then all evidence relating to that serious criminal conduct will be effectively concealed by in-camera rulings.
In fact, at the beginnings of the internment cases in 2003, we posed a very specific question in the short hearing you have before they go into closed evidence to a security service agent behind a curtain, anonymized, saying, because by then evidence was coming out about exactly what was happening in Guantanamo and secret sites around the world, and the question was, do you make use, would you use evidence based on torture? And the answer was yes, of course.
And you know,
the
that
only question is what weight we give to it.
I mean, as we're dealing with these things just today, too, I mean, you take the case of Binyam Mohammed, the British resident who was in Guantanamo Bay. I mean, he told me ages ago about how he was horribly tortured in Pakistan, Morocco, and Afghanistan. And so then we get into this litigation here in Britain about whether this should be revealed to you, the public. And I've seen the classified evidence. I can't talk about it. I can't tell Binyam about it. Now, the Americans and the British get together and say they have a protocol that they've agreed to on sharing of intelligence that says that they cannot reveal this evidence of torture publicly. Well, think about what that means for a second. That means that America and Britain are conspiring to conceal evidence of criminal acts that were committed against Binyam Mohammed, the criminal act of torture. Because they've got together. I mean, I suppose if the mafia got in an agreement like that, they'd be very grateful. They go kill a few people and they have an agreement that we won't talk about it publicly. You can't do that. And indeed, you know, Section 52 of the International Criminal Courts Act here in Britain makes it an independent crime to conspire to cover up evidence of torture. It's horrifying, really.
We've got past the state now, haven't we, where states are able to make agreements to enter into anything together. They're bound by international law. How is this situation being able to continue with all of these international checks and balances in place?
Well, it's because people don't do anything about it. I will say I have a little plan for the American government that we're going to put into effect in the next couple of weeks, which is we're going to sue them in America in order to get a declaratory judgment from the judges saying that their little wheeze that they have with the British government to cover up evidence of torture is a criminal offence and they can't do it. Now, one of the fun things about this, and I must say it's quite entertaining, is that then the government has to respond. What are they going to say? I don't care what they say. They either say, yes, we are going to do this, in which case they look horrible, or otherwise they admit they can't. And I think what's crucial for all of us, and this is not just lawyers, it's you and the media too, and everyone else, is to keep pressing and illustrating the bizarre nature of this. Otherwise, we're going to gradually just let slip those liberties we have.
Ian MacDonald, if I could just come back to you. Mm. How has this political situation been impacting the legal system in the UK? Do we not have a proud tradition of fairness and justice in this country? And how are lawyers and judges working within that system reconciling that tradition with what's been happening?
Well, the tradition that we have is a tradition that was fought very hard for. Go back to Magna Carta, go back to practically any major human rights thing. They were all fought for, and the people who fought for and won those would all be classified as terrorists today. So the tradition of civil liberties and of freedoms is not one which has been given and not one which it's been upholden because of the pressure of public agitation. That's why we have them. And if that goes, then those freedoms go. I think one of the things which I've been quite concerned about is that none of the things that are happening in courts and are happening with all these control orders has ever been linked properly to the economic situation against which they are all posed, starting in South America, in trying to impose some kind of corporate neoliberal economy and they have all been imposed in one way or another, either by torture or by locking democratically elected governments up attempting to impose a new kind of ideological economy on countries throughout the world. And the torture, I think, is linked to that. Originally, torture, I mean, everyone realizes that torture is useless at obtaining the truth. And so why do people continue to do it if it's not another form of terrorism to say, look, if you people agitate, we're going to take you in, we're going to leave you in this condition. And you've had lots of instances of bodies which have been severely tortured being left on the wayside for people to see. And it's a form of terrorism. It's nothing to do with the collection of intelligence or information, as far as I can see.
Ian Cobain, you've been a reporter for many years. Do you see what you're dealing with now as part of a longer-term trend that actually predates the so-called war on terror?
Yes, I think what we're seeing is a continuum, quite frankly. I don't think that this is just a reaction to something that's happened after 9/11 at all. You only have to look back at what was happening in Northern Ireland in the early 70s when the British Army was using the so-called five techniques. And the then Home Secretary, Reginald Maudling, was standing up in the Commons in November 71 and saying, it works, and it's worked for us for years. So I don't think it's a sudden catastrophic response to 9/11 at all. I think what we're seeing is on some sort of continuum, and it needs to be, I'm slowly realising that it needs to be resisted continually, as Ian says. Two or three years ago, I was quite relaxed about the state of our civil liberties in this country, and only through working on these series of reports that I slowly begin to realise not only that British government officials were arranging for people to be tortured overseas, but that there was a government policy underpinning what they were doing. And that effectively what's been happening in recent years is the British government has been arranging for its own citizens to be tortured at different locations around the world. And I think that represents the most appalling abuse of executive power. There's no sign that the legislative branch of the UK government is capable of restraining this or stop checking it in any way. Most of the British media has ignored it. So far, the courts have been unable to check it as well, and hopefully that will change at some point in the future.
In terms of what we're dealing with here, there are two very separate issues. You know, one is torture and the other is secrecy. And I must say, in my opinion, by far the most questionable and terrible legacy of the last few years is the secrecy more than the torture. We'll win the torture battle eventually. People see that. What they don't see is the secrecy business, and that creeps up on them. But you see it throughout society. It's not just in this notion of torture that they conflate national security with national embarrassment. You see it in the MPs' expenses. I mean, how long did we hear the MPs saying, oh, we don't want FOIA to apply to us, we don't want freedom of information? Well, now you know why they didn't want it. They didn't want it because it was so excruciatingly embarrassing. And, you know, free speech, I worry about this country, Britain, sometimes, and the whole free speech issue. I don't think this country has ever accepted into its bloodstream the notion of free speech in the way that it needs to, because it's terribly dangerous when you let government officials decide that they don't want the people to know.
I just want to pick up on what Clive said. Ian, there's also been talk lately about secrecy spreading from outside the terrorism context in the immigration and criminal courts and to other areas of the justice system, employment tribunals, probation, parole board hearings. Do you think that some of the developments in terrorism have set a precedent that's having wider implications now?
Well, you don't know where it all came from, because the other area where secrecy is really dangerous is in large corporations. And there's no way of getting into them and what policies they're making. And particularly when an awful lot of stuff is being outsourced to those international bodies, so that it's much more difficult, and it's much more, it's a kind of creeping problem, and much more difficult to deal with. I think secrecy has been inherent in much of certainly British government, and to a certain extent local government, and within corporations before 2001.
But let me give you an example on that. I mean, you'll remember the time that the British finally admitted that they had assisted in the rendition of two Pakistani chaps from Iraq to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. And I wrote to John Hutton about that, saying, look, why don't you tell us who these guys are and we'll reunite them with the rule of law. I just got a letter back from him or his office saying that they're not going to tell us who these people are. And part of the basis for them not telling us is the Data Protection Act, for goodness sake. So you have this thing that we've created to protect citizens from the government prying, which the government then turns around to protect themselves from having to tell the truth. And the idea that these two guys are languishing in Bagram Air Force Base somehow want their privacy respected by not letting them have lawyers is so ludicrous, it would be funny, except for the fact that they're suffering and have been for 5 years.
I want to just talk about the future. A lot's been blamed on the Labour government in the past 12 years. Do you think that a change of government might see a change in this trend of secrecy? Gareth, what's your view on that?
We have an appetite in this country for secrecy. It's very nice to be a member of the club inside sharing a secret. We found it extraordinarily useful in pursuing our perceived economic and strategic objectives as a country to share without question secrets with the most heinous regimes. This is what we do. In advance, whatever party it might be in the future might give, and this is perhaps the best hope, might give some commitment to change and could be held to it. But there's too much, as Clive says, of a lack of an ethos of questioning. There's apathy politically here. And frankly, it breeds cynicism on both sides. The government realises it just has to legislate again in a new form if the victims win a victory. And the victims have the same bleak cynicism. However we win, they'll find another way. It takes a fundamental, extravagant change of demand that our rights are our rights and we have them, and it's not in the gift of a government to give them.
Clive, could I just ask you, because you've been bringing cases in America as well, what is the impact of the Obama administration coming in, and is that going to lend momentum to change?
Well, I like Barack Obama. I voted for him. I think he's a decent chap. And if you've read his book, Dreams from My Father, it illustrates the human being. But I was terribly disappointed with our charity. The moment he got elected, one of the funders in America said, oh, we don't need to fund you anymore. Everything's solved, you know. And of course, what we've seen is exactly the opposite. And partly is two things. One is Obama is a compromiser, and he's got a lot of people to compromise with, and he compromises too much. You know, he loses sight of some of his principles. But at the same time, you've also got to recognize that he inherited so many poisoned chalices from Bush. And the Democrats are utterly spineless, and they failed to support him. Only 6 out of 100 senators recently voted to provide any funding for closing Guantanamo Bay. But Obama's done some bad stuff, and he's continuing the rendition process. He's got Bagram, the evil twin of Guantanamo Bay, which is far bigger. You know, people don't realize that actually 98% of the prisoners being held by America beyond the rule of law today, as we sit here, are not in Guantanamo Bay. They're in Bagram. They're in Iraq. And unfortunately, Obama is perpetuating that whole process. So we've got a long way to go, and he's fighting us on the revelation of secrets left, right, and center. But, you know, we're not going to give up. We're having a little fun with him at the same time. But the last time I tried a little wheeze with him, you know, they tried to prosecute me. And they really do this stuff to intimidate you. But I guess it's never intimidated Gareth.
At least there's a whistleblower's exemption in the United States. In this country, if you work for the security services, intelligence services, no exemption. You'll be prosecuted to the gallows, effectively, to send a message.
Ian, is that why they are so determined not to allow evidence of their own conduct to come into the public domain? And do you think that will continue into the future?
I think it will continue into the future, and I think we need to continue to resist it as best we can. For a while, I thought that the reason why evidence of criminal wrongdoing on the part of British government officials was being heard in camera was because somebody had taken the decision that national security and the reputation of the security service were in some way synonymous. And then the penny dropped, and of course I realised actually that's only part of the story. It's also partly so that the security service is not put in the position of being asked, well, were you authorised to do that? And were you authorised to not do what you didn't do? Because the next question would be, well, who authorised you? So a lot of the secrecy in court cases is to protect government ministers and former government ministers who've signed off on what has been happening.
Ian MacDonald, do you think there's any cause for optimism in the future?
No, I don't think there's particularly cause for optimism, but it really depends upon the extent to which people resist what is going on. But I think secrecy is institutionalised in Britain, and to some extent I don't think it matters who you have in government, it will still operate. And I think the case of the difficulties that Obama is having in keeping to his principles is something that anyone taking over a government in this country would also have. I'm not particularly optimistic, but what I do think is that not necessarily starting in Britain, but there is an awful lot of opposition to the things that are going on throughout the world, and that world out there consists of billions of people.
That's it for today's programme. Thank you very much to our guests. Remember, you can watch our series of films on the real-life story of five people who have suffered through the use of secret evidence on The Guardian's website. Plus, there's more comment and analysis on Comment is Free. I'm Afua Hirsch. The producer was Francesca Panetta, and that was Closed Court.
For the best online debate, go to commentisfree.co.uk.